I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Simon Chowett Johnston joins me now. He has just published a new novel, The House of Wives. In 1862, Emmanuel leaves Calcutta for Hong Kong. He leaves behind a wife, Sema, as he attempts to make a fortune in the opium trade. While in the Far East, he falls in love with a woman 20 years younger than him, and upon their marriage, builds her a large mansion. Their lives change when Sema arrives unannounced. I'll get Mr. Chowett Johnston to tell us as much as he can about what happens next, the genesis of this book, his own journey, looking at his own family's history and how that informed the story in The House of Wives. Simon Chowett Johnston is Artistic Director Emeritus of the Gateway Theatre. He was at the artistic helm of the Richmond Theatre Company from 2000 to 2012. He's written a number of plays, including Sisters, Rice Rockets and Yacht People, Wildcat, Ghost Mountain Guest, and Running Dog, Paper Tiger, among others, which have been produced in at companies throughout the country. He has also written a number of radio plays and television shows for the CBC. The website for more is at simonjohnston.ca. This book is published by Penguin. He lives in White Rock, where he joins me from today. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Simon Chowett Johnston. Mr. Chowett Johnston, good morning.
Good morning to you, too, and how nice to chat about the book.
Yeah, so it's just happy about it. And it's just come out, and apparently it's on the bestseller list already.
Yes, I'm very proud of that. It took me by surprise, and I'm still recovering. It came out in the Globe and Mail on the weekend. After 1 week on the shelves, it has hit the bestseller list, and I'm thrilled. I can't be more happy about it.
And I've read what people have said about the book who've read it, and the notices have been quite good, and so that must be pleasing as well, other than having a bestseller say.
Well, to have Terry Fallis say those nice things about you, of course, is always a treat. And Joe Curtiz, whom I admire and have admired for decades, and Plum Johnson especially, who has a similar approach to writing as I do. To have these individuals, along with Jim Wong Chu, who is, of course, the godfather of Asian-Canadian writing in B.C., and Annalyn Kay, who was the former editor of Rice Paper Magazine, to put their endorsements in. You know, I'm just very, very blessed and, frankly, just surprised and overwhelmed by the reaction.
Well, I've started it, and I've read bits of it, and I can tell you, and not just because you're on, that I think that those notices are well-deserved, because it is wonderfully written.
Oh, thank you.
And I think that's what people are reacting to, just how beautiful it is and what you evoke. This is a time, I guess, the story starts in the 1860s, is that right?
Yes, the story starts in the 1860s in India. It is loosely based or inspired by the lives of my ancestors. My great-grandfather was Emmanuel Belilius, who was a Jewish opium merchant who was born in Calcutta and took he was married at that time to a wonderful woman by the name of Sema, also from the Jewish community, and they had a very happy marriage. They were a very prominent family in Calcutta, and he bought opium from the foothills of Calcutta and took it to China to trade during the 1860s, and of course opium was legal in those days. And while he was in China and Hong Kong, he fell in love with a young Chinese woman who was 20 years his junior thereabouts, and her name was Pearl. Legend has it that he stayed in Hong Kong. Sema, tired of waiting for him in India, came to Hong Kong. The three of them, legend has it, might have lived together in a magnificent house. And so I exploit that legend. I have no proof that they actually did, but it's always good to speculate when you're dealing with fiction. I don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. So just to try and get the genealogy right, Pearl had at least one daughter. Uh-huh. And that daughter was my grandmother, Felice Belilius. And Felice Belilius married a Malay Korean Chinese man by the name of Choa. Mm. And so they had my mother, and that's how, and because this is very much as much my mother's story as it is mine, I put her name next to mine as a sign of respect and reverence to the story that she could not tell.
This is not something that I guess you talked about a great deal with her. I think you asked her once in the course of when she was alive. Is that right?
That's right. When I was about 8 years old, I asked her once, you know, Mom, I know who my grandmother is, but who was your grandmother? And who was your grandfather? In other words, my great-grandparents. And she looked at me and she said, your great-grandfather was a man named Emmanuel Belilius, and he was an opium merchant. And I remember looking up at her and thinking, what's opium? Mm. And I and, of course, it's been decades since then that before I discovered a box amongst her papers when we moved her into Yale Town down in downtown Vancouver, which was in her mid-90s at that time. And in the box were letters, photographs, and diary entries and notes relating to her life and to her father's life and her mother's life. No real direct communication about Emmanuel and Pearl, but that gave me the impetus. That gave me the interest. That was my doorway into researching about my great-grandparents, and I couldn't let it go. I mean, I was obsessed with it. Of course, during the 2000s, the Internet was available, and of course, that was a very powerful tool to really delve deeply into the layers and layers of archives that are available now online. And I took several trips to India and China and Hong Kong and managed to find and trace the roots and all the houses that they lived in and also see some of the philanthropic works that they left behind. They were really charity givers to hospitals and schools and orphanages that still exist today.
And he founded, your great-grandfather founded a bank, is that right?
Well, he didn't found the bank. He was the chairman of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank in 1872, mm. and also a director of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. And, of course, the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank is quite notorious. It goes back 150 years or thereabouts. And the trading that was happening, not only in opium but in other things, they serviced all of those merchants who were in China during that period of time. But yes, he rose to quite a prominent position and as chairman of the bank. It was also decorated by the British Crown and received all sorts of other accolades.
So you talked about your mom and the one time you guys talked about this, about her, about your family, essentially.
Yes.
What do you think it was that made her say reticent to talk about it? Do you think she didn't know what was going on, or did she know and didn't really want to talk about it?
Yes, we'll never know exactly what that was, because she never had a conversation with me about it, even though I prodded her as I became a young man and later on in life. I suspect that you know, it wasn't something that you talked about in those days. Mixed marriages, for example, were not exactly accepted in her day when she was younger, right?
Even encouraged,
Or encouraged. And then, of course, she was a Christian. And to find out that her grandparents were Jews might have also influenced her to sort of not talk about it too much, and what that meant, what that dynamic meant, and what that tension might have been. So those were the influences. It was about religion and about society and status and that kind of thing, which, of course, to me is of consuming interest, and people of my generation really want to find out more about the dirt of what happened in their forefathers. And I'm fascinated by it, but you know, for her, it was probably still alive in her mind and her consciousness. So she probably didn't want to talk too much about it. So just from a from a sense of society, you know.
So what you didn't know, is that what informs the story in The House of Wives?
Totally. What I didn't know and had to find out through the internet, through dusty archives, museums, different university archives as well, and also looking at the various locations, formed the story and informed it as well. I was more interested, after I found out all the facts of the story, or as many facts as I could find, I was more interested in getting inside people's heads and finding out what they were feeling about each other and what they were feeling about themselves and the times that they lived in. I was also interested in looking behind closed doors, behind walls, and what were they talking about? How did they live? How did they relate to each other? How did they find the compromises that was that were required for a peaceful coexistence? And what happened if they faced tragedies? So all of that is the traffic of the book, right? It's the stuff that is not written down is what I explore in the book.
And so how much time, like in terms of just research, did you spend, say, in Hong Kong?
Well, of course, I was born and brought up there, and then when I returned, they would be at a couple of weeks at a time, and then of course there was follow-up correspondence through email with all the people who were helping me do the research in those areas. So I didn't spend much more than a couple of weeks at a time because, you know, I had a full-time job at that time. I was executive director of the Gateway Theater, and that was a big job to do. So it took me from about 99 through to about 2010, about a decade worth of research. But it wasn't every day. It was a couple of hours a day here and there. And then some trips to really capture the sense and the feeling of place.
So if you hadn't made those trips, whether they be in Hong Kong or India, you probably would not have gotten the sense of these places.
That impossible. Impossible.
Yeah.
You have to walk the streets. You have to look at the buildings. You have to smell the smells. You have to see how far one thing is away from another, how long it takes to go from one point to another, what they might have seen. You have to experience the weather, and you have to see the documents and touch them and feel them, you know, in all the places that they worked. And so that was what was fascinating for me. I really loved delving into that. And people were, you know, the library archivists and other guides that helped me out were very, very supportive of this and were as fascinated about finding the wayfinding of all of these places as I was.
The one on your website, simonjohnston.ca, and
yeah.
There's a blog there that you've updated over the last little while, and
yep.
There are photographs of the house. Now,
yep.
The house, does it still exist?
No. The house was torn down in 1926. The house that you see called Kingsclere, the massive 114,000 square feet of white pile of this, it's like a castle, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
That house was actually the second Kingsclere. So Emmanuel had several other houses prior to that time in different areas of Hong Kong, and he also had a house on the Peak, which is very unusual because Jews were not permitted to have property on the Peak in a British colony at that time, but he did. The house that you're talking about, the large one, the large white castle-looking house, was actually built in the 1890s, in the latter half of the 1890s. And it only lasted for about 30 years. And I use that as the metaphor for the House of Wives. So in my imagination, they all lived in that one. I mean, you know, it would have been very, very difficult writing a novel where they were living in all sorts of different houses.
Mm.
And the tension is much greater when you put everybody in one place rather than in separate places. So in the novel version or in the fictionalized version, I have them all living in this big house, which was probably not possible from a chronological point of view. So I've used what do you call poetic license to include that house, which was too tempting not to include.
Would this the arrangement in the House of Wives of this man Emmanuel and his wife, his two wives in a house like that, would that have been, say, I don't know if permissible is the right word, but would it have happened during that time?
Yes. There are many stories of very famous and prominent and rich men who had several wives, concubines or protected women, some of whom were living together, and some of whom were actually recruited by the chief wife into concubinage. And so it was not, it would, well, I think some prudes would probably think it unusual, but actually there was lots of that going around everywhere.
What?
Within the colony.
Yeah, so what, in the course of researching your family's history and now writing a novel about it, what does that change in terms of how you view your life?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. Discovering, being born and raised as a Catholic, a Roman Catholic, going to a private school run by Catholic priests and Christian brothers, and then suddenly to discover that no, actually, you know, you derive from Jewish culture was quite a surprising dynamic in my life, and so I'm still thinking about that and what that means as to who I am. When you think you're one thing, and then suddenly you are given another dimension that walks around with you all the time. You know, you can't avoid it, right? So ask me again in a year or two, and maybe I'll have a better answer. But right now, I'm thinking about it. It's really quite a new sensation.
So I guess that's the change, that you're spending more time thinking about this than you otherwise would have.
Yes, totally. I seem to be obsessed by the whole mixture of the races.
What do you think your mom would have made of this book?
Well, I wonder. You know, nobody's asked me that question before, and I would say that she would go through it with a fine-tooth comb and try to find all the punctuation errors. She would be looking for spelling errors, and she would probably compile a list of them and then give them to me without much comment on its other content. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking that she was quite a stickler for good grammar and punctuation and spelling.
Yeah. What you have other family members, obviously cousins.
Yeah.
Have they had a chance to read the book yet?
Some have, and most of them have averaged reading it in a couple of days or two or three days, and they feel that it's a real page-turner. They really lighted on the things that you mentioned, that it's very evocative of a place and a time, and they were quite happy with it, and happy that they didn't have to spend 10 years researching this, and they could just do it in 2 days. but I have 32 cousins scattered around the world, and of course children and the grandchildren and the spouses and so on, so there's quite a number of them, and I haven't heard from all of them yet, so I've heard from maybe a handful, and so far so good, thank goodness, otherwise I'd never be able to go to a family reunion again.
But regardless of what they think of the book or what you've written, you all share this heritage. You share this ancestor,
yeah.
And you haven't had any discussions with some of the readers in terms of how they view themselves in light of what they know now of where they came from.
No, I haven't had that conversation. That's really a new topic. And I've been quick to put a caveat to everybody to say, you know, this is a version. This is not the version. Please, family members, do not mistake this as a biography or a history. It is neither. It is a work of fiction. And I am proposing that wouldn't it be interesting if this happened as a way of understanding something about my ancestors? Because the facts are very dry, and they don't allow me to enter into a conversation with them or to see them as real people with faults and with triumphs and with human emotions and passions for each other. So I wanted to know them as real people as much as I know my own family.
So the characters in the book, Sima, Pearl, those are the two wives, and Emmanuel,
yes.
Because you didn't know much about them and you had to flesh them out in the course of writing The House of Wives, did people you know in your family or yourself even, did they inform any of these characters as you wrote them?
Oh, yes, they did. you know, Sima is based, has some aspects of an aunt that I knew very well, and embodies maybe three or four different people that are in my immediate family. So, yes, she does. And Pearl, certainly the Chinese wife of Emmanuel, embodies some aspects of my grandmother and some aspects of my mother and some aspects of various aunties. So yes, I used an amalgam of people that I knew in order to inform who they were.
Now, you've written plays in the past, Simon. You've also tried writing a novel previous to this. I guess, do we call this your first novel?
We call it the latest novel.
The latest novel. And so, is there, I mean, I'm always curious to know in terms of the process of writing, because you've written plays in the past, radio dramas as well, television shows. Is there a difference in how you approach writing, or is it all for you writing and it's all one thing, say?
Fundamentally, no, there isn't a difference. It's about character, and it's about the characters in opposition to something or to characters who are struggling against something. So it's about how interesting a character is. So essentially that is the fundamental thing that is germane to all kinds of dramatic writing. And curiously enough, The House of Wives began as a play. I was invited by the Stratford Festival to be playwright in residence there. I think it was 2010. And I had already done a tremendous amount of research by then, and I was writing a play about it. But as I began to develop the play, it was clear to me that it required a larger canvas. So a play would be about 80 pages, whereas my novel is 300 pages. So I was able to use the novel form to really explore a wider and canvas, but it was always based on who is the interesting characters and what are they in opposition to, what are they struggling for. So it was a combination of the two elements, I think. But maybe that's why the novel is so cinematic, if you will. There's you know, a lot of the scenes are explained as though they were on a stage. You know, you can see the characters on a stage, so that might have influenced it in some ways.
Yeah, Plum Johnson says it has a theatrical sweep of opera.
Yeah.
So
well, thank you, Plum.
Yeah. So does that? I mean, I read somewhere that you are thinking of adapting it to the stage. Are you?
No, it was in the context of why isn't it a play? Mm-hmm. And I explained about the size of the canvas needed to be larger. But I now know that if I were to turn it into a play, I would know how to do that now. I didn't when I first started out because I was struggling with finding the story and finding the characters in the world that they were in. But now that I've completed the book, it is possible to look at it being a play from fresh eyes, yes.
And you launched the book this past weekend. You had an event, I guess, in White Rock and at the Gateway. Is that correct?
There were several book launches. So the first one, it was in Toronto on May the 4th. And then we toured Toronto a bit. We went to London and Hamilton, Dundas area, Stratford, and then came back. And we had a launch in at the Gateway Theatre. It was very, very sweet to put that on for me in Richmond and at Peninsula Productions here in White Rock. And then there's one tomorrow night at the BMO Theater in the Olympic Village in Vancouver. That's the location where the Arts Club and Bard on the Beach have their offices.
Right.
And that beautiful new theater. So we have an event going on in the lobby of the theater.
That's May 17th.
That's tomorrow night, yeah.
Yeah.
7 o'clock.
So what, after the I guess, nascent success that you've had already, what does that do in terms of say, encouraging you to pursue, say, another novel or other writing? I mean, are you working on something new now?
Yeah, I'm working on something. I'm thinking of a sequel. The current novel, House of Wives, ends kind of open-ended. And I'd like to explore what happens after that and perhaps bring it into the world of my mother and my grandmother in the 1920s and 30s. So I'm thinking about that now. I think there might be a way to give those women a voice.
Not that you asked, but I mean, after talking to you these last few minutes about the process of writing this book and discovering who you essentially are or where you come from, I mean, there's a story there, don't you think? I mean, even if it's nonfiction, say.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not as keen to write about me. I feel much more comfortable writing about other people and about other characters rather than me. I don't find myself that interesting.
Huh. Well, I'd beg to differ, and I'm sure other people would as well. So,
well, that's very kind. Thank you.
This has been such fun talking to you about this book. I can't wait to finish it.
Great.
It's a fine achievement, and so congratulations and continued good luck with it, Simon.
Thank you very much. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and to discuss this book.
You're very welcome.
It was a labor of love, and I hope other people it that way.
Yeah, no, it's clear already from the few pages I've read of it. The website for more, simonjohnston.ca. The book is called The House of Wives. It's published by Penguin. Simon Choa Johnston joined me on the line from White Rock, BC in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.